Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent describes the suffering of refugees he sees in northern Greece. We remember former First Lady Nancy Reagan. We speak with the author of a book on what a U.S. presidential nominee needs.
We really have to have a president who can attract that brain trust to deal with these gigantic issues.
And an American organization is empowering African girls. It's right here on the Voice of America. There are poignant historical ironies buried in the turmoil of the current refugee crisis in Europe as people flee conflicts in the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia. Correspondent Jamie Detmer is traveling in northern Greece, where refugees are sleeping near tracks once used to transport Jews to their deaths. And we have him on the line. Welcome, Jamie.
Thanks for having me on, Susan.
Well, tell us about this historic link.
Well, there are lots of ironies and historical echoes really in the current crisis. First of all, you mentioned about how refugees in northern Greece are sleeping on railway lines that run through a camp that they've converged on just before the Macedonian border, which is basically closed to them. And these rail tracks were the ones that transported the Jews to Salonika back in about 1943-44 to their deaths. 98% of the Jews of Salonika died in the concentration camps. But there are other echoes. I don't want to bore you with too much ancient history, but we've seen forcible displacements and huge flows of refugees really for hundreds of years in this area. It is the crossroads, really, between mainland Europe and the Middle East, which partly explains why you have these kind of tectonic political plates that keep rubbing and grinding. And each time they do, hurtling hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of people, into a very new life, shattering their previous lives. Back in the 19th and 20th century, we had huge flows of Greek Christians from Turkey. They were forcibly displaced after a war between Greece and Turkey. And Turkish Muslims expelled from Greece, more than 2 million people, across the Aegean Sea, which is now being passaged by Syrians and Iraqis, trying to find sanctuary from their wars.
What are the refugees there telling you today?
They're bewildered. Many of them have been there for 3 weeks, 2 weeks. There are about 16,000 now. The camp was built for 1,500. There's very little water, running water around, just a few taps. There's very little food around. Doctors Without Borders, which is basically running the camp, because there's very little evidence of state assistance. The Greek government doesn't seem to be able to get control of this. So they're hungry, they're tired. There's a terrible respiratory infection going around, particularly amongst the kids. 55% of the people there are women and children, many pregnant. Many pregnant women there, some widowed. They are despairing, they're frightened, they're anxious, they're getting no information from either the Greek government or the Macedonian government about what is going on. They're looking towards the summit today between Turkish leaders and EU leaders, hoping that something comes out of that. Some even are giving up a little bit of hope. About 50 Syrians and Iraqis have entered into the relocation scheme that the EU has been offering last year, where there are meant to be 66,000 refugees relocated across European countries. They don't get to choose which country. In fact, only 325 have actually been relocated in the scheme. So there's a sense of great fear.
Well, thank you very much, Jamie.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today. And joining me with the details is our social media person, Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Susan. Always good to be here with you.
Nice to have you here.
Well, we had sad news this past weekend.
Yes, we
that former First Lady Nancy Reagan had died at the age of 94. And even though that news broke this weekend, people are still talking about that and still remembering her.
I think they will until the ceremony for her memorial service.
Oh, absolutely. And case in point, the White House just announcing today and putting on social media that they're lowering the flags or ordering the flags lowered to half mass, which is a sign of respect here in the U.S. when someone passes away. Mm-hmm. So that memorial coming from the White House, that directive. And then also you see a lot of the Republican presidential candidates honoring Nancy Reagan.
Are they tweeting out about it?
Tweeting out about it, tweeting their condolences. Ronald Reagan, of course, is the figure in the Republican Party. So Nancy Reagan is as much of a figure as he was, as a revered figure. So a lot of people expressing their condolences there. And a lot of people sharing this quote from her speech when she went on the Just Say No, the anti-drug campaign launching that. She said, "There's a great, big, wonderful world out there for you. It belongs to you. Don't cheat yourselves out of this promise." So people actually taking that out of the context of drug use and saying just it's a general life motto that we can live by, that there's a great world out there and we should try to grab it while we have it. So
you got something else going on today?
Yes. Well, speaking also of politics, it's a day ending in Y, so that means there's a debate. And in case last night, there was a Democratic debate in Flint, Michigan between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. So Twitter noting two of the top tweeted moments, one where Bernie Sanders told Hillary Clinton, "Excuse me, I'm speaking."
Yeah, people said that was
He lost his temper a little bit. People accusing him maybe of some sexism. And then, of course, Bernie Sanders also saying the word huge, which Donald Trump is known for saying. And Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both from New York City. So when they both say huge, they say it in the same huge kind of way. so Bernie Sanders noted, he said, "I don't like to say that word because I know Donald Trump says it." So actually that was the most tweeted moment of the debate when he said that word. So
okay,
go figure.
I think that's huge, Andrew.
That is huge.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists have found evidence of the rare element curium in a carbon-rich meteorite. This radioactive element is not known to occur naturally on Earth, but instead is manufactured or is produced as the side effect of a nuclear explosion. Curium wasn't discovered until 1944, when Glenn Seaborg and his colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, created the element after bombarding the atoms of plutonium with alpha particles. The researchers who detail their discovery in the journal Science Advances suggest that the curium wound up in the meteorite during the formation of the solar system after a gaseous cloud that went on to create the sun condensed. The researchers say that they believe that finding this rare material in a meteorite may cause scientists to reconsider current models of stellar evolution and nucleosynthesis, which is a change in the chemical composition of a star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
As Andrew was telling us, former First Lady Nancy Reagan, wife of the late 40th President of the United States, died of congestive heart failure Sunday at her home in Los Angeles, California, at age 94. Ronald Reagan died in 2004. After they married in 1952, the former actress came to play a significant role in her husband's political career, which began in 1967 as a two-term governor of California, followed by two terms as president from 1981 to 1989. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with the University of Virginia's Larry Sabato, who calls her an outstanding first lady.
She fulfilled the first duty of a first lady, or eventually a first gentleman, which is to support the president in every way possible, to give him unvarnished advice, so that he, or eventually she, always knows that the advice is being given with the interests of the president at heart. That's precisely what Nancy Reagan did. And she played a very significant role in the administration that we're only now beginning to fully understand. I would mention in particular her encouragement of every possible effort at negotiation between the United States and the Soviet Union. She wanted a positive peace legacy for her husband, and in fact, she helped him achieve it. The truth is that the Reagan administration did, in fact, in its second half, do a great deal to further better relations between the dying Soviet Union and the United States.
Rice University's Douglas Brinkley says Mrs. Reagan was tested early in her husband's first term after an assassination attempt on his life in 1981.
We forget that Ronald Reagan was shot only a couple months as president, and Nancy Reagan spent much of both terms taking care of him, making sure that his health was okay and that he was getting the right amount of rest, because that was a near-fatal incident.
She's considered by many as his closest advisor.
There's no question about it that Nancy Reagan was his closest advisor. I mean, certainly in foreign affairs, he'd turn to Secretary of State George Shultz, or on domestic politics would go to James Baker. But after Ronald Reagan heard everybody's advice, he would have a quiet word with his wife and what she thought mattered the most to him. And what we know as historians of where she weighed in on things, but was most particular in her urging her husband to negotiate, to talk with Mikhail Gorbachev, to try to reduce nuclear weapons stockpiles. So she plays a role in the thawing of the Cold War and the eventual demise of the Soviet Union in 1991 by giving her husband steadfast advice.
What is her legacy in your view?
She was a great Hollywood actress of her era, but she once famously gave a quote and said, "I'm not so concerned about my career, I want to get married." And she was married and became a mother, took on adopting Ronald Reagan's two kids with the previous wife, Jane Wyman. So she had to raise four kids and then kind of helped navigate her husband's political career, not just as president, but in California politics, where she was First Lady of California during the tumultuous 60s, and then became a very popular First Lady, although at times controversial in the 80s. And her Just Say No campaign against drugs as First Lady, and then as ex-First Lady, she became a leader in the crusade to find cures for Alzheimer's disease. But she's really going to be known as the alter ego of Ronald Reagan.
Nancy Reagan will be buried alongside her husband at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California. Coming up on International Edition, reading up on choosing a president and empowering young Maasai females. The United States is in the thick of the process of selecting candidates for president in the two main political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. But how does a voter choose? Here to give us some tips is Loyola University professor Emilio Iodice, who is author of 2016 Selecting the President, the Most Important Decision You Will Ever Make. And he joins us on the line from Rome. Welcome, Emilio.
Thank you very much, Susan, and thank you for the invitation to talk about the book and also the process that each of us as Americans have to go through to really vote for the only planetary leader. And that's what I say in my book, that the President of the United States is the only real planetary leader. And that's why our vote is so important. And the book focuses on those leadership traits that a president must have today. And I use examples from history, from a number of different presidents, to come up with 15 major traits that we find that are absolutely essential for the commander-in-chief. None of our presidents have really had all 15, but our greatest presidents have had the ability, number one, for instance, to be a reformer. They've had courage. They've had character, the ability to convey a message, a vision. They've also had emotional intelligence. These are among the most important qualities in addition to relevant experience. And I go into this in great depth in the book.
Well, this is a very important time to choose the best candidate for the White House because the world is in such turmoil right now, especially the Middle East, places in Africa.
Well, that's where I begin with the book. I lay out the great issues that the next president will face. And I begin by explaining that a president, of course, doesn't govern alone. They have to bring in a brain trust, the best and the brightest, in order to deal with these lethal problems that we're facing all over the globe, whether it's international terrorism, whether it's epidemics that are still with us, whether it's the economic problems that we're facing both in the United States and around the globe. These are all very, very serious issues, and they require the best talent, the best minds to come in. So we really have to have a president who can attract that brain trust to deal with these gigantic issues. Each and every one of them by themselves, like the environment, requires international cooperation. It requires communication. It requires a great deal of study and engagement around the globe. And the United States has to really have a commander-in-chief that knows how to do that.
You need somebody with diplomacy skills.
Diplomacy is very, very important, and where you get that could be from either the State Department, where I come from originally, from the field of diplomacy, or it could be even in the private sector. There's some diplomacy involved there and, of course, international business, but it requires really understanding where the ball is going to bounce as far as these great international issues.
You know, you have these points that we should keep in mind as we're choosing a candidate, but can we really judge these candidates by what they say and how they present themselves? I mean, do we ever really know what they're like?
Well, one of the things that we've learned from history, and again, I explain this in the book, that their background does have a relationship to what they do in the future. It really does. So the way they've performed and acted in the past really is a way that they will also act in the future. We see it, for instance, with Franklin Roosevelt as governor of New York. In the time that he was there, he started dealing already with the Great Depression, with the unemployment problems that were facing the state. And we can see it with every single administration where their background does have an echo of what's up ahead. It teaches them how to separate noises from signals, and that's what we need to understand. Can they separate the great noises from the signals?
And the name of your book again?
2016, Selecting the President, the Most Important Decision You Will Ever Make, and it's on Amazon.com.
Well, thank you very much, Professor, for your time.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sagan, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
International Women's Day, March 8th, VOA's Julie Tabo in Washington and reporter Jill Craig in Kenya shine a spotlight on a U.S.-based organization that is empowering young Maasai girls through education.
Gloria Kotente Mometa is training to be a doctor.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. As a medical student from Kenya, she's learned a great deal in the 8 weeks she's spent in hospitals in and around Washington.
So this is the right kidney?
Mm-hmm. And she hopes to share that newfound knowledge with her peers back home.
My experience here has been great. The doctors are great. I've got to do a lot of things which I wouldn't have done in my country. I've learned how to use an ultrasound to scan patients. That is a program we don't have in my school, and that's a program I would love to start in the future.
There's a ventilator in the back.
Seeing a young woman receive medical training is not an unusual sight in a large hospital like this, except Gloria is a Maasai. An ethnic patriarchal tribe in Kenya and northern Tanzania, in which less than half of all girls attend primary school, and only 1% go to college.
A Maasai girl doing medicine in my country is a big deal. And most of the time I get that question, you are Maasai and you're in med school. How did you get here? It's been a great journey for me.
Will you stick that?
No. Gloria's journey began when she learned about the Maasai Girls Education Fund, a U.S.-based organization with offices in Kenya's Kajiado County that provides young Maasai women and girls with scholarships based on need for free education at boarding schools in Kenya. It was founded in 1999 by Barbara Shaw, an American who believed that educating girls will empower them, their families, and their communities, and lift them out of poverty.
MGF Barbara Song.
Shaw died in 2013, but her daughter, Tracy Piles, is continuing her mother's work.
It started with two little girls that she first met while on a photography project in Kajiado district of Kenya and staying among the Maasai in their village.
The number of girls helped by the organization has now grown to more than 150. Gloria is the first to go to medical school and train at Suburban Hospital, where Piles works as an emergency physician.
Someone like this, who has the heart that Gloria has and the desire to go back to her home, and make a difference, needs, in my opinion, to be invested in, supported, given every opportunity to make the most, because what she has the chance to do when she goes home is incredible.
The organization has proved that girls who go to school are less likely to be forced into early marriage and other cultural practices.
We have rescued girls as young as 9 who were already married, also from FGM, or female genital mutilation, which is still something that is practiced among the Maasai.
These young Maasai are among the girls who've been rescued from early marriages and are attending school. And thanks to the organization's community programs, attitudes towards young Maasai women are also changing, especially by fathers.
It's only as these girls come back, educated, teachers, doctors, lawyers, that's when they're coming to see the value of educating their daughters.
A good example is Lucy Anteya, a graduate of the program who's now its Kajiado office director.
This new generation of Maasai girls who are now getting an education, they are now showing their community that they are bringing a lot of empowerment, and they are showing the community that it is not just about a one-time dowry, but they can do a lot for themselves and for their families and for the country.
It's hard to overcome strong cultural beliefs and ingrained practices, but you're never going to do it by telling people that they're wrong or bad. But by demonstrating and showing people how their own lives can be better, that's the way to affect change.
Gloria Kotente Mometa is back in Kenya now, spending time with her family and friends and completing her 5th and final year of medical school at the University of Nairobi School of Medicine.
For me, being a doctor will just have remained a dream. But now it's a reality. Yeah.
Julie Tabo, VOA News.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Study after study has found that one of the best ways to jumpstart a sluggish economy is to invest in women. Because when women take part in the formal economy, they pull their families and communities out of poverty. Still, many women face barriers that undermine their ability to start or expand their business. In particular, in many countries, women find it very difficult to access financial services. Too often, they cannot secure a loan, or they are charged a far higher interest rate than men. In late February, U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues, Catherine Russell, joined representatives from Kiva and the Inter-American Development Bank to launch the Women's Entrepreneurship Fund, an initiative that will help expand access to finance for women in 83 countries. When lenders respond to a woman entrepreneur's request for a loan through Kiva's online platform, the fund will match their contributions dollar for dollar. At the same time, the fund will collect data and measure how effective the initiative is in expanding women's access to finance. The data will help illustrate the financial needs and activity of women entrepreneurs around the world. The Women's Entrepreneurial Fund initiative seeks to improve the lives of women by removing limits on their ability to fully participate in the formal economy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.